All right, so I need to make a confession right up front. I don't have a dog in this fight. Okay, so my heart is with the Cowboys, so I just don't have a dog in this fight. Maybe some of you do, but I just don't. Now I understand that I've read some stories that Green Bay is favored. I think you owe me some points for at least knowing who the teams are, since I don't have a dog in this fight. But you see, I don't have a belief really in my heart either way. I mean, like the rest of you, I can probably get pretty excited about competition. But you know, I don't have a firm belief operative here for the event this afternoon. I am kind of impressed by all the security and by all the NFL people that are in town. That kind of impresses me. But I really don't have a dog in this fight. That's probably in part because I was raised overseas. And you see, I didn't, even though I went to some schools in which there were a lot of Americans, I really didn't become a part of the American sports scene. So I played football in college and played basketball, well, not in college, in high school. And I played basketball, of course, when we did physical education. But I never got involved with American sports because I didn't come to the United States until I was 17. And so, you know, by that time, most of your sports interests are already firmly planted. And they're part of your life. They're part of your faith. They're part of the way in which you see the world. Now, when I was in high school, part of the time I was in high school, I was in Bangkok, Thailand, and then the other part of high school, I was in Rome, Italy. Boy, what a hard place to go to high school. And so I played soccer in Rome. But you see, part of the reason why I don't have a big dog in this fight is because, really, until I came to live in the States during my senior year of high school, I really wasn't a part of the American sports culture. If you give me a sports page today, I'd have to sit there and learn how to interpret it. I'd have to read very slowly in order to make my way through it, in order to find everything that many of you go to automatically. So you see, it's not part of my heart's conviction to be either with either of the teams today. But I do have strong convictions about some other things. For instance, I've got a very strong conviction about Frasier, the TV show. So when it comes to, you know, you asking me if I like a comedy series, the answer is very quick, it's Frasier. If you ask me if I have convictions about other things, for instance, what airline do I like to fly? Is Bernie here this morning? It's American Airlines. I've got a very firm conviction about that. I've got firm convictions about what kind of cereal I like in the morning. If I'm eating cold cereal, I want Captain Crunch or I want Fruit Loops. It's very, very serious with me. I do have some very strong convictions, some very strong beliefs, and what I believe usually translates not only for me, but for all of us into what kind of activity we engage ourselves in. Right? So what we believe, what we have strong convictions about, translate into how we perform, translate into how we act, translate into how we relate. We are taking a few weeks off of our study of the book of Colossians, and this morning I'd like for you to come with me to the second epistle of John. Now remember, an epistle is not the wife of an apostle. An epistle is just a big word for a letter. John the apostle wrote three of them. He wrote 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John. In addition to those three letters, the Apostle John also wrote the Gospel of John, and he wrote the final book of the Bible, the Revelation, or what we sometimes refer to as the Apocalypse of John. In his second epistle, his entire letter is grounded on these assumptions. What you believe makes all the difference in how you relate. What you believe makes all the difference in how you relate. As a matter of fact, he begins with a couple of words in the first few verses of this little letter that immediately cement these realities for us. The elder, that's what he is calling himself, he is the elder to the chosen lady and her children. Now, this is probably metaphorical speak. But by the chosen lady and her children, he probably is using the metaphor of an elderly matronly lady who has many children under her care in order to picture the church as a place in which the children of God have gathered, the church as the place in which you find God's kids. God's kids are identified as the community of his sons and his daughters. And so he is writing to some church, probably one particular church, maybe a couple or three, but he is writing to a Christian community or perhaps communities, which he refers to as a lady and her children. Notice he says, whom I love in the truth. And not I only, but also all who know the truth, because of the truth, which lives in us and will be with us forever. Grace and mercy and peace from God the Father, from Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, will be with us in truth and love. Now, did you notice the two words that are right at the front of John's mind as he writes the introduction to this short little letter? Two words, but two words which signify two huge concepts. Did you catch them? Truth and love. Those two words appear through those first few verses repeatedly in order to signal to us that for John, you cannot divorce these two terms. Wherever you have one, for the Apostle John, you must always have the other. Wherever you have truth, you must have love. And wherever you have love, you must have truth. These two are inseparable. They go everywhere together. You never find them apart. Truth and love. Let me use some synonyms for truth and for love. Doctrine and relationships. Doctrine and relationships. Let me use a couple of others. What you believe and how you act with others. What you believe and how you act with others. Truth and love. Doctrine and relationships. What you believe and how you act with others. Those two concepts for the Apostle John cannot be divorced. They cannot be separated. In other words, he is hitting us with this reality. What you believe is going to determine how you act. Whether or not you hold to truth is going to determine whether or not you love with authenticity. He begins to develop this idea a little bit further into this letter. So notice verse 4. It has given me great joy to find some of your children walking in the truth. Well, that's a backhanded comment if I ever heard one. It's given me great joy to find some of your children walking in the truth. That's like having a couple of friends over for dinner with the whole family, and as they walk out, as you're giving them their coats and as you're shaking their hands and as they're thanking you for having them over, they turn to you and said, we really enjoyed being with some of your kids. Yeah. And of course, you immediately know which ones they're talking about, right? We really enjoyed being with some of your kids. Yeah. It's kind of like the book review, right? Where the reviewer of in the New York Times book review section is reviewing a book and says, "I liked some of what the author said. I liked some of what the author said." We use that kind of language in order to indicate that some of it was nice. Some of your children were well behaved, but there were some that weren't. It's a backhanded compliment. It's exactly what John is doing here. He is insinuating, he is implying that this church somewhere in Asia Minor that he has metaphorically spoken about as a mother with her children, that some of her children, some of the members of the church are in line with the truth and other members of the church aren't. In other words, some of the members of the church are walking in the right way. Some of the children are putting their feet in the footprints left behind by the truth. So wherever the truth has gone, that's where some of her children have gone. But some of the children have seen the footprints in the snow or in the ice, and they've decided not to put their feet in the footprints that have been made by the truth, but instead they've decided to go off over here. They've decided to wander off the trail that has been left by the truth. The truth has cleared a path. The truth has shown the way to navigate safely through the ice, but some have decided not to do that. When Pamela and I woke up on Tuesday morning, wow. We have a driveway that is quite steep. The thing was, as I'm sure many of your driveways were, was covered with a sheet of ice about 2 inches thick. We could not get out of our driveway. It was amazing. And so I didn't do anything about it Tuesday. Didn't do anything about it. Well, no, Wednesday I did. I got up and I got some salt. No, we didn't have very much salt in the house. We had some Morton's iodized salt, you know, a couple of those shakers, but that's all we had, so I used it. And by using that along with a shovel, I was able to cut 2 tire tracks from the ice so that I was able to back the car out. And, of course, as soon as I did that, I drove to another grocery store and bought them out of salt. I just bought all the salt that they had. I came home with 10 containers of salt and was able to clear a good part of the rest of the driveway. Well, that's what John is saying the truth has done. The truth has cut a path in the ice. The truth has allowed you to travel in safety in the place which is, well, both true and ethically and morally proper. But only some of your children are doing that, lady. Only some of the people in your church are loving. In other words, some of the people in your church have stopped loving. Some of the people in your church, John is saying in a soft way, have stopped loving. They've stopped caring about the needs of others. They may be using the language of love, but they're not loving in a Christian way. Maybe they're failing to watch out for each other's physical needs. Maybe they're failing to watch out for each other's emotional needs. Maybe they're failing to watch out for each other's spiritual needs. Whatever it is, people in this church have stopped loving. So notice what he does in verse 5. "And now, dear lady, I am not writing you a new command, but one we have had from the beginning, I ask that we love one another. He renews an old command. John is not novel. He's not doing anything new here. He's not creating something which is unheard of. John is going back to the past. John is going back to the old. John isn't doing anything contemporary here. John is a fan of the antique. John loves the antiquated. John loves the old. And what he does is he goes back to the antiquated, he goes back to the old, and he brings it back again and says, I'm not writing you a new command, but one we have had from the beginning. I ask that we love one another. John is having to renew the love command in this church, in this community, because some of the people in the church have stopped loving each other. They become concerned with themselves. Pamela and I were listening to a song over to church this morning. They focused on what they deserve because they're bloated with entitlement. Right? They become bloated with entitlement. What they think they deserve and what other people need to give to them, they've stopped loving others because they're bloated with the sense of entitlement, the sense of being loved rather than of loving. And this is love, he says in verse 6, that we walk in obedience to his commands. As you have heard from the beginning, his command is that you walk in love. Now that's the second time you've seen that verb, walk. The first time you saw it was up in verse 4 when he said that only some of your children were walking in the truth. And now he reminds us that his command is that we walk in love. You see, you can't get away from what he introduced at the very beginning. You cannot divorce these two realities. You cannot divorce truth from love. You cannot divorce doctrine from relationships. You cannot divorce what you believe from how you treat others. And so we are to walk in love, and as we walk in love, we will recognize that what we're doing is walking in the truth. When we walk in the truth, we will recognize that what should be produced is love. So here's my question. What is it about the community to which John is writing? What is it about this church to which he's writing? What is it about this community to which he's writing that has caused them to stop loving each other? Why have they become bloated with entitlement? Why have they focused on themselves rather than on each other? What has caused them to turn into themselves rather than outward to others? Well, he tells us in verse 7. You ready for this? It's probably not what you expect. Many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh have gone out into the world. Any such person is the deceiver and the antichrist. Now, I don't know what y'all were expecting, but I would imagine sometimes when somebody asks the question, why did Joe stop loving Joanne? Why did Lucy stop loving Ted? Why did he stop loving her? Why did she stop loving him? Why did he stop loving him? Or she stopped loving her? Why? Well, you know, a whole bunch of reasons might be thrown out. Oh, they just couldn't communicate. They had different life goals. They had different interests. They couldn't forgive each other. They wanted to go different ways. They liked different things. He irritated her too much. Okay. Make a note of that. These are the kind of responses they couldn't communicate well. These are the kind of responses that we would normally expect. What we don't expect is verse 7. Many deceivers who did not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh have gone out into the world. Any such person is the deceiver and the antichrist. Here's what John is saying. John is saying that the reason why people in this church stopped loving each other was because some false teachers wormed their way in. Because some false teachers slithered into the community like snakes during the night. Because some false teachers, like spiders, crawl into your bed and leave those streaks up your legs and up your arms from their bites. You never see them coming and you never see them going. They just made their way in. These false teachers spidered their way in. And these false teachers had a particular doctrine they were teaching, or should I say a false doctrine. These false teachers were denying that Jesus Christ came in the flesh, that he had real skin, that he had real meat, that he had real bones, that he had real blood vessels, that he had real blood flowing through his body, that he had a real heart that pumped, that he had a real mass of flesh in his skull we call a brain, that he had teeth and eyes and ears. They denied that he came in the flesh. In other words, they believed that Jesus was divine. They believed that he was God. They believed that he was spiritual. What they didn't believe was that the eternal Son of God, who had existed with the Father from before all ages, that the eternal Son of God, who was as divine as the Father is divine, became as human, as fleshly, as bodily, as bony, as skinny, as meaty as you and me. That's what they denied. They believed in the deity of Christ. What they denied was his fleshiness. What they denied was his humanness. And that had caused them to stop loving each other. Because here's what those false teachers say. You know what? God didn't really become human. God didn't really take on flesh. God didn't really take on bone. God really didn't take on blood. Nah. And since God didn't do that, you don't need to be concerned with those issues in other people. You don't need to be concerned about their blood. You don't need to be concerned about their bones. You don't need to be concerned about their skin. If God didn't love what we are in our physicality enough to put it on, then you don't have to love physicality either. You don't really have to be concerned when a person shivers. You don't need to really be concerned when a person is thirsty. You don't need to really be concerned when a person is hurting. You don't really need to be concerned with their meatiness, their boniness, their skinniness, their bloodiness, because God would never love it enough to put it on himself. Did you see what John calls those false teachers? People who say that God the Son did not become as human and as fleshy as we are, those are the people that you align with the Antichrist. You want to know how to spot the Antichrist in our society? You spot the Antichrist in our society by those people who love to talk about the deity of Jesus, but who like to turn down the volume on his fleshiness and his humanness. Dear friends, what you believe really determines how you act. Your doctrine really determines how you relate, and the truth that you embrace really determines how you love. Because God loved humanness so much that he put it on himself, Since God loved bloodiness so much that he put it on himself. Since God loved boniness so much that he put it on himself. Since God loved skinniness so much that he put it on himself. Since God loved eeriness that he put it on himself. That God loved eyeness enough that he put it on himself. That God loved footedness enough that he put it on himself. That God loved knee-ness enough that he put it on himself. That God loved hairness enough that he put it on himself. You don't have any option if you believe in the incarnation of God the Son. You don't have any option except to love people in the totality in which they exist. You cannot love a person just spiritually without loving them also physically. We are obligated to love people spiritually, emotionally, and physically if we are going to own the name of Christ and call ourselves Christians. The greatest act of worship you might ever do today is to give a thirsty person a drink of water. The greatest act of worship you might do today is to put a blanket around the shoulders of a shivering child. The greatest act of worship you might do today might be that when you walk into the house and your five-year-old grandchild runs up to you at the Super Bowl party, or your 10-year-old child runs up to you at the Super Bowl party, as you get on your knees and you hug the stuffing out of them. Because God loved their stuffing enough to put it on. If we are going to be Christians who can honestly and with integrity say that we love each other, we have got to love every bit, every part, every piece of each other. Because those who deny the fleshiness of Christ are the Antichrist. Those of us who are pro-Jesus Christ confess with everything that is in us that he became like us in every way, yet without sin. And we project our faith in his incarnation by loving people as they are in the totality of what they are. Reach out today and love somebody in their fleshiness. Reach out today and love someone in their emotion. Yes, reach out and love somebody in their spiritness. You've got a big job, and for that, we all need the help of the Holy Spirit. So let's cry out for it together. So, Father, we cry out to you that you would dispense the power of the Spirit upon us, that by the power of the Spirit we would live lives which declare that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh, and that we would declare this to the world by loving human beings in the totality of what they are, in the totality of what you have made them, and that you will find us sensitive and self-sacrificing to all of their needs, spiritual, emotional, physical. We ask it through the Son and by the Spirit. Amen.